You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen, and we're taking a few weeks off from bringing you new stories so that we can replay you some of our favourite episodes from the last 12 months. This week, we're playing you an episode we called Discomfort Zone, which is all about doing things that make you uncomfortable because they're good for you. Which is why I'm currently riding a bike. I hate bikes. I hate the way they make my body feel. I hate the seat the most, I think. It's just like digging into me. Anyway, I guess it's good for my body, so we're gonna do it. Here we go, up the hill. In our first story, Millie gets naked with her friend. A content warning, this story contains exactly one swear word and a little bit of nudity, but this is the radio, so you don't really need to worry about that. Someone came out of the house as I was struggling up the hill. That was very embarrassing. I'm just gonna go around in circles instead.
I'm in the bathtub right now. It's about 1.5 meters by 70 centimeters of white narrow porcelain, and there's barely any room to sit up comfortably. The water temperature is pleasant, it's cool to step into, and I've added a few drops of bubble bath to make everything smell like lavender. But I'm not alone in the water vessel. I'm with my friend Shani.
Yep, hi.
And we're both naked, crouched up with our knees facing each other and our arms are dangling out for support. But hey, it's weird for the two of us as well.
Can confirm.
See, Shani and I are completely platonic. We've only known each other for about a year. But I forced her into this nudist cleansing session in homage to a television scene that has stuck with me since it first came out in 2012. Have you seen the first season of Girls?
I have not, no.
Okay, so the protagonist, Hannah, is in the bath and she's singing Wonderwall by Oasis and she's doing a terrible job at it. And then her best friend, Jessa, she walks into the bathroom and she's very, very upset. And then Hannah stops singing and she just looks at her best friend and Jessa wordlessly starts taking off her clothes and she just hops in on the other side of the bath. And now she's like full on crying and she wipes her snotty nose on her hand and then she puts the snotty hand into the water. And then Hannah breaks the silence by saying something along the lines of, "Hey, everything else about this is fine, but not the snotty bath water."
Yeah, valid.
Valid. And it's raw and it's intimate and it's vulnerable and it's normal. And it's something I guess I've always envied and yearned for in female-identifying friendships. I don't know about you, but like in front of sexual partners, I can gallivant proudly in the nude. I can be completely in my birthday suit. And when I'm alone, I forget that I'm naked. But yeah. Front of my girlfriends, I kind of feel on edge. And when I have to strip in front of them, including right now in the bath, I always make sure, I don't know if you've noticed, to make explicit eye contact, like I'm not looking down, don't worry.
Oh yeah, same.
And I'm always comparing my own body and wondering whether my boob size or my pubic hair or my cellulite is normal, and that like a little voice in the back of my head is wondering, are you judging me? Are you?
No.
No? Good. I can politely ask Shani to strip and wade in water with me. But I wanted to learn how to naturalize being nude in front of my friends without it being a big deal, by chatting to people who do it all the time.
In the last couple of years, my roommate Amelia found acceptance and comfort in her skin.
I would always be one to be quite anxious in like change rooms and just feel so awkward and like I didn't belong. And it often led me to sort of have a panic attack and then piss mum off a bit because she couldn't understand what was going on. But I think the reason why I was just so uncomfortable is because, you know, I was quite cognizant that I was this sort of lanky brown body with a white mum that looked nothing like me. And I'd walk into these shops with basically, you know, white models with curves and hips and breasts. And it's quite sad to look back on it and think, about how much self-doubt I had in myself. I think I still struggle. I still make this joke that I have the body of a prepubescent teenage boy.
Amelia went on exchange, studying in Boston, which opened up possibilities and situations she wasn't used to, but embraced wholeheartedly.
I was single and I was in a city that was very conducive to like my exploration of being a queer person of colour. And quite a few people I knew were, you know, not like walking around nude, but they'd often just take photos with friends in intimate platonic settings, being nude or just casually dressed in lingerie. I found comfort in that. And so I guess I came back to Sydney feeling like I'd grown in many ways, but also including in a sense of a healthy relationship with my body. And so over that 2018, 2019 summer, I mean, maybe it was because it was hot and I'm a cheeky Sagittarius, but I became like that friend who just always flashes in a photo and just like wanted any reason to just like take my top off and just like walk around in no pants.
Amelia found a reason when she went to the ladies' baths in Sydney with friends. The secluded area allows women to go topless or not, offering a safe place to make that decision.
I remember it was New Year's Day of 2019 and a couple of friends and I went to Coogee. I had never been there before, so I was quite excited and, you know, pulled down my swimmers and I had one piece on and I just, like, tied the straps around my waist. Yeah, and we were just, like, lounging around the pool and I really don't, like, care to, like, draw attention to my breasts. But I found myself, like, putting leaves on my nipples and, like, laughing with my friends about it. And it was strange, but also a lot of fun. Like, I was like, oh, look, they're, like, little hats for my nipples. Like, we were all queer. I think that's an important point to make, is that I think I've found my relationship with my body has grown through queer platonic friendships with women and non-binary people. There's not a pressure to be attracted to each other, even though we could be, but that's been like a vessel towards feeling okay.
Then there's my friend Ash. We're colleagues, so don't worry, HR, we haven't seen each other nude, but the 30-year-old journo has always been comfortable without a thread on.
I've always been nude in front of my friends. So, like, if we get home from going out somewhere and you take off your shoes and then, I don't know, you'd sort of just, like, if you take off your top, if you've been at the beach and you're just wearing, like, swim bottoms or shorts. When we were growing up, we were always quite sort of body confident. There was no real stigma around nudity. Like, whenever we would have, like, sleepovers or whatever, there wasn't that whole, I'm going to get changed in the bathroom and, you know, hidden away or anything.
As an adult, Ash surrounds herself with friends who embrace nudity just as much as she does. It's so a part of her world that only rarely does the practice catch her by surprise.
One of my friends is like full-blown, like my best mate, super comfortable around each other. And I vividly remember one day we've been at the beach, she gets home, takes off all of her gear and we grab salads. She's sitting on my lounge, butt naked, not a stitch on, eating a salad out of the cardboard box. I'm like, mate, get your bare bum off my bloody lounge. That is where I sort of thought, I don't know about eating together nude. I went with two friends to a Korean spa and they, if anyone's been to one, it's very invasive. And they literally confiscate your clothes. And we were laying on these plastic massage tables, all being scrubbed down together. And you just sort of have to laugh because so pared back. Not to sound too sort of cheesy, but it's just really nice to be super comfortable with your mates and have those friends where you can say anything and do anything and completely be yourself, unabashed version of you. And sometimes that means that you have no makeup on and you have no top on because it's bloody hot, it's Aussie summer, and you just want to watch a movie with a mate, eat some Cornettos and not have a bra on. What could be better than that? That shit is bonding.
Do you have to have a certain degree of familiarity with your friends, or say if it was a new person in your life, how would you navigate being nude in front of them?
I think it's just courtesy, just to sort of test the waters. If they're a bit strange about it, I probably wouldn't, like, we were staying together, I probably wouldn't just be like, I sleep in nude, because they might not be comfortable. So I think that when it comes to any kind of platonic nudity, still respect is important.
So begging your mate to have a bath with you at Shani might earn you a blocked number. There's so many reasons why someone might hesitate to be nude in front of their pals. So I hit up my friend Imogen Ivy for advice on how to ask someone to get naked. Imogen is a photographer, and her walls are filled with intimate portraits of women's bodies.
When someone's nude, I don't think that they're nude. Like, it's that past. So I've done nude photography about 5 years now. I've done over 600 photo shoots. When you do something every day, it's like, you know, making a cup of tea. Like, if you were nude right now, I would not even fucking flinch. And I know that's crazy, but if you see the kind of life I live, it's just, it's so normal. Well, I grew up in a predominantly female household. I have a beautiful father and my parents are together. When I was raised, he travelled a lot. And so in the house, often it was just like my sisters and I and my mum. Nudity was so normalised in my childhood. And at that same time, I realised that it wasn't common. I was 14. I remember it very clearly. I was at one of my friend's houses. It was a Friday night. And my mum that day had told me a really funny story in the bath. I bath with my siblings and my parents still do. For me, it's normal. If you're listening to this, I'm sorry if that's not normal. My friends, like, and they were predominantly men, boys, just started laughing. They're like, what do you mean bathing your mum? And they wouldn't even listen to the story. They're like, that's so fucking weird. Like, what do you mean? And I was like, what? Because the way I was raised, it wasn't never sexualized. It was never uncomfortable.
Like with her family, Imogen is super comfortable with her friends as well and led to all types of shenanigans growing up.
My friends and I would do an annual nude drive. So I have like this old Beetle, right, and it's got no roof. So we would drive nude, fully nude. We would wear hats and shoes only. It was so much fun. It was a bit of thrill. I'm not saying you should do it. It's very illegal.
Imogen soon began using her friends as muses to capture and embrace bodies of all shapes and sizes.
So I started photographing my friends and it was just for fun, like 100%. And I put a few on Instagram and I was, you know, kind of shocked with the amount of people that wanted to join in. And for me, I just wanted to show the fun and the freedom because I shoot everyday legends. But I never thought strangers would contact me or even like follow me and be like, hey, I want to be shot. I want to do this. And I was like, oh, okay.
For Amelia, Ash and Imogen, personal boundaries, acceptance and respect are foundational in their ability to be comfortable around others while naked.
I think I have grown to be very proud of what my body has survived physically and mentally, because I think there's such an important relationship with your own body, but also I'm surrounded by people who do remind me that the body I live in is one that is worthy and deserving and beautiful.
I just think nudity is like any other skill you acquire. The more you do it, the better you become at it. Just keep it legal.
You can be comfortable and confident and be nice and loving and forgiving to your body. Doesn't mean you have to be nude. God, no. That's just how I was raised. Like, it doesn't matter if you're showing your skin or not. If you ever want to be more comfortable being nude, great. If you never want to be nude, great. It doesn't matter.
There's no universal experience in showing the most vulnerable side of yourself, even in front of the people who are meant to know you best. I won't be putting leaves in my boobs, eating salad, or driving around naked anytime soon. But it's all about taking those baby steps, one tub at a time.
Can we get out of the bath now, or... we can hang here.
That story was produced by Millie Roberts. The supervising producer was Sarah Mashman. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show and you're in Sydney or Melbourne, you should come along to one of our pitch workshops. You'll learn all about how stories for the show get made and how to craft your pitch. The workshops are happening on the 17th of March at FBI Radio in Sydney and SYN in Melbourne. You can find all of the info at allthebestradio.com. When Ellen was 19, she decided to travel to India alone. She was nervous, but the biggest thing holding her back wasn't her own anxiety. It was everyone else's.
Thank you. When Ellen Fraser Barber was 19, she found herself traveling alone on an overnight train journey to Darjeeling, India. She was way out of her comfort zone. She had not planned to be by herself.
I was the first person to get on in my little section. And then one man came, and then the second man came, and then the third man came. And then I felt really nervous about being in a contained space with three men that I didn't know.
She also had this growing fear that she'd have no idea when to get off the train.
Yeah, I was always anxious. I didn't know how long I was going to be sitting on this train for. Didn't know, like, what I would do if I got off on the one station.
Ellen is hearing and vision impaired, so she couldn't read the station signs, and she wasn't able to hear the names the train conductor called out. She was also coming down with a nasty cough. She felt miserable, laying on her bunk with her bags under her legs in the middle of the night.
It was really dark. I felt the man above me climb down the bunk, and I just laid in my bunk bed pretending to sleep. And then he was going under my legs, and I could feel the bags moving.
This was exactly the kind of situation everybody had tried to warn her about. You see, Ellen's path to this moment began the year before.
When I finished high school, my dad got really sick with terminal illness. There was a lot of mess and chaos and stress and anxiety and sadness. I've gotten myself into such a dark place at home, and I just really needed something that would take me out of that reality that I had.
After her dad passed away, she decided India could be that something. But nobody else agreed.
Everyone told me not to go, or that I was crazy, or don't risk it. You're deaf and blind. You can't go on your own.
How did you keep it from getting into your head and thinking, I can't do it?
I think I was just really convinced in myself that I should do it. It did get to me, though. It made me very tense. I was so frustrated with all of the people around me who were really drilling into me with all of the anxiety that they had. And I think I have made a decision that that was their anxiety, it wasn't my anxiety. There was such a build-up of tension leading up to that moment of me getting on the airplane.
Ellen knew it was going to be challenging, scary, and even dangerous. But she'd done her research, and she decided to take the risk anyway. She'd organized to stay with an Indian family for the first month. She figured this would be a safe way to find her feet.
There was Rippy. Rippy said that she was my Indian mother. And then there was Karminder Singh, and who was a gentleman, a real gentleman, like a grandfather figure. You know, very gentle, quiet man.
So her Indian family picked her up from the airport, and they all hopped in a taxi together.
The first impression was, I can't explain it even. There was just like a really different smell that didn't smell like Australia to me. And, you know, the road just so busy and chaotic, and there's lots of honking, people literally hanging out the windows, holding on from the roof. Very different.
Ellen didn't want to just do the tourist things. She spent the first month volunteering at a school for deaf and blind children. There were lots of volunteers from all over the world, but she was the only one who lived with disability.
I pointed to my ear and to my hearing aid, and then I would sign the same as you. Their faces just lit up. They were really happy, and they'd just say, yeah, me too, and I'd point to their hearing aid.
So she settled into her new Indian life. She worked with the kids during the day and socialized with the volunteers in the evening. It really wasn't as scary or as hard as everyone had warned. One weekend, Ellen took a trip with some of the volunteers. They went up to this small farming village high up in the Himalayas. It felt really remote. There was no electricity. It was one of the most remarkable experiences of her entire trip. But in the village, a man told her something that left her feeling deeply unsettled.
One of them said to me that it's really important that you're here because you can show people that people who are visibly different, who have a disability, can live a good life, can live a full life. Whereas if I had been born in India, I probably wouldn't have had a life.
He went on to tell her that in some parts of India, she might have been drowned at birth, that there are very little resources for people like her, and that a lot of people with disability ended up on the streets. It was horrible to hear, but he wasn't trying to be mean. He was truly happy to see her living a good life, and he wanted others to learn from her. But Ellen was feeling very conflicted by this. She thought about the kids she'd been volunteering with.
You can't expect these young children who are living in India to see me as a white Westerner coming in and showing them the way, because I can't do that. I did have a lot of opportunities and a lot of support and a lot of services and a lot of resources that were driven towards my development as a young child. If I had been born in India, I don't think I would have had those resources. But also, I think it is also important for them to see the ideal and what it could be and how those resources could be used in a way that makes a difference for them too. I don't know. It was a challenging experience.
After Ellen left the school, she joined up with a tour group. They were a really fun, eccentric, eclectic group of people from all over the world. And they had a really great time traveling together. But when they arrived in Varanasi, she discovered the group was disbanding. She was the only person that had booked onto the second half of the trip. And she had to make her own way to Darjeeling, about a 13-hour train ride away. She had not planned or prepared for this. And she was starting to get sick. She was in this tiny train compartment with three male strangers. No one spoke to her. She was coughing. Her anxiety was building. Then, in the darkness of night, the man in the bunk above crept down the ladder. She pretended to sleep, but then she felt him reach under her legs. Her bags started to move.
I leapt up and was like, "What are you doing?" He startled and then went back up to the bunk. I was petrified. I just didn't lie down again. I just sat on my bed with my belongings behind me.
She sat frozen like that until night turned to day. But when the sun came up, it didn't do too much to minimize her anxiety, because now she needed to figure out when she was getting off that train, and quick. Then the man across from her suddenly spoke to her. He said he'd heard her coughing all night and wondered if she needed any medicine. She declined this offer, but she thought he seemed genuine.
He just seemed to care. So I said, "Oh, can you tell me when I get to this stop?" And I pointed to my itinerary and I showed him where I wanted to get off. And I said, "Please tell me when I get to this stop." And he said, "Yes, yes, yes." Every time the train stopped, I said, "Is it this stop? No. Is it this stop? No." 3 hours later, "Is it this stop? Yes, you're getting off here." And he helped me get my bags and put me off the train there.
So that was it. She asked for help and figured it out. Everyone who told Ellen that she was crazy to risk traveling on her own when she has limited vision and hearing, they might say she got lucky. And they'd be right. She could have been robbed, or missed her train station, or been taken advantage of, or any number of terrible things. But all those things could happen to anyone traveling alone. And still, lots and lots of people do it. And that's why she gets so frustrated when people are so amazed that she's done it.
Yeah, the only thing that I worry about with a story like I went to India on my own is that I worry that it would be considered to be inspirational. Any young person can go to India on their own and people won't really react to it. But because I have a disability, when I go to India on my own, everyone reacts to that story.
And the reason that's a problem is because it's directly related to the kind of thinking that too often keeps people who live with disability stuck in the safe zone.
everyone wants to protect you or to remove anything that might be harmful or risky, and that is actually the most unhelpful thing that anyone can ever do, because if you don't take risks and if you don't make mistakes, you can't possibly develop any sense of identity. It's about learning our own limits and what we can do rather than what other people think that we should or shouldn't be able to do. And going to India was a big message to everyone to just shut up and leave me alone and let me do what I want to do. And I think they got the message loud and clear. They really did.
That is 100% how this story will end.
Yeah.
That story was produced by Carrie Shear. Carrie Shear is the producer of the Purple Orange podcast, where this story was originally heard. Our final story this week is from producer Saskia Black. It's called Time Poor to Time Rich.
I used to be busy. I'm not saying that I was the busiest person who's ever existed, ever, but I was busy. I was busy for me. I was busy at work.
I was busy seeing family.
I was busy seeing friends.
I was busy writing.
I was busy recording.
I was busy reading.
I was busy running.
I was busy commuting.
I was busy cooking.
I was busy on social media.
I was busy listening to podcasts.
I was busy running.
I was busy cleaning.
I don't know why I just said cleaning. I wasn't busy cleaning, but you get the idea.
I was busy. And it made me feel stressed, as if I was being pushed and pulled and yanked by time, the thing that I had none of. No, that isn't right. It didn't feel like that. It felt as if I was in London, central London. And I was walking down a really busy street, trying to get somewhere. To the right of me, there was traffic. There were cars, buses, mopeds, cyclists. And on the pavement, there were people. Thousands and thousands of people. A crowd. And in this analogy, I had to be somewhere. And I only had moments to get there. I was running late. I was running out of time. And I kept looking at my watch, seeing that I only had a matter of minutes and seconds to go. But every time I tried to weave my way through the crowd, they wouldn't let me. They keep talking to me, keep trying to sell me things, keep trying to ask for directions. And I wanted to help them, but I couldn't help them because I had no time. I was running out of time. And that's how I felt. That's how I felt until we moved to Australia. And since coming here, I've gone from being time poor to being time rich. I have time to create the things I want to create. I have time to listen and read and watch whatever I want to. It's as if I'm no longer walking down a really busy street, but a path, a coastal path. And I'm the only one on it. There are no children playing. There are no dogs barking. There are no engines revving. There are no horns beeping. There are no alarms ringing. There's nothing but the sound of a clock. And it's ticking slowly because time is moving so slowly. I have so much of it. Time. And the trouble is, I don't like it. And I'm definitely not a mind reader, but I guess you're wondering why. Why can't I appreciate all these minutes and hours, days, weeks, months that I once longed for? And my answer is simple, because I realise I don't want to be thinking about time at all. I don't want to be thinking that I have loads of it. I don't want to be thinking that I have none of it. I do not want to be thinking about time. And as well as not being a mind reader, I'm definitely not a philosopher. But I'm pretty sure most of them say that's what contentment is, right? But the trouble is, I only ever really do when I'm with my friends and family. When I'm with them, I'm not looking at the clock, but they're also far, far away. But this isn't meant to be a sob story. This is meant to be a story about how I went from being time poor to being time rich. And now it's time for me to go.
All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Lee Robinson. Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find all of our episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe.